I met Suzanne Groth from Groth Vineyards earlier this year at Auction Napa Valley's Barrel Auction. In fact, a brief interview with Suzanne was featured in the special Barrel Auction podcast that we did back in summer. Suzanne's warm personality and sincere hospitality is yet again one more reason we keep coming back to Napa Valley. Groth Vineyards is located in Oakville, which is known for some fantastic cabs. I spoke with Suzanne on a foggy afternoon in September of 2008, and when the fog lifted, we tasted. Suzanne, tell me how Groth Vineyards started.
Groth Vineyards is originally my parents' dream. So Dennis and Judy Groth started Groth Vineyards by purchasing a vineyard. They were only going to be growers. They had no intention of making wine. And my mother voted for Beach House. He voted for something agricultural because at the time, the accountant in him knew that it was a better investment and it was a better tax write-off, essentially. That was in the 80s. That doesn't happen so much anymore. It's not as good of a tax write-off. But they kind of backed into the wine business that way. And in the first year, they realized right away that there was no way to make their investment back, even at, you know, the prices of land then in Oakville, California were modest compared to today, but they wouldn't make their money back selling grapes. Cabernet, for example, was worth $400 a ton. Today, it's worth $2,000 to $10,000 a ton, depending on which vineyard it's coming from. Their neighbor, Justin Meyer, was a guy well-versed in the wine industry. Had started Franciscan and turned around, started Silver Oak. Knew a lot about making wine and in the business of wine. So he decided to give him some friendly advice and said, start a brand. Let's see, 27th harvest this year. So pretty cool.
So how old were you when you arrived in Oakville?
Well, I was 12 at the time. We moved up here full time when I was in high school. So I went to Santa Elena High School. There was not a lot for us to do in high school growing up here. But, you know, once I went away to college and lived in other places, I lived in Portland, Oregon, where I went to school. I lived in San Francisco. I was in the hotel business. I wanted to be an artist. And when that dream fizzled and died, I turned around and asked my dad to point me in the direction of getting in the wine business. Not working here yet. I was 20s. So I ended up working for a distributor and selling wine in San Francisco to everybody from Beverages and More, and then later to restaurants when I learned more. And it was a world-class education on how to sell wine. So it was a good time. It was exciting. Finally, when I was trained enough, they decided to pull me in to sell wine at the winery. So that's how I ended up here.
About how many years was that?
Let's see. I worked for Henry Wine Group for 5 years, and I, you know, fooled around in San Francisco in the art world for 3 or 4 years. So it took me about 8-9 years before I finished college and came back to the winery. But I had an art history major, not really very applicable to the wine business. So my father was interested in me training elsewhere before going on his payroll, so to speak. But it was a good move, actually. And I traveled extensively for the winery my first 4 years. So I did nothing but travel to, you know, West Coast accounts, East Coast accounts. I did Texas a lot. Went down there. They drink a lot of Cabernet and Chardonnay down there. Had some experience working with our distributors and learning about them. I mean, some of them date back to the day we opened as far as our history in selling with them. So it's neat to meet people that know more about Groth than I do. And that's been a great education. So, but then I started having babies and needed to stay a little closer to home. So that's why I'm more at the winery these days.
Who is the winemaker here at Groth?
Well, he's the second in the illustrious history of Groth Vineyards. So we don't believe in a lot of change around here. So our second winemaker is Michael Weiss. He has been with us for 14 years now. Our first winemaker, so we started with in business and was one of our original partners, Nils Vangi. There was a winery next door called Villemont Eden. Today it's rented out by Plump Jack. They lease the land to make the wines from that property. The McWilliams are still the owners, but my parents tasted that wine. That was one of the reasons they were interested in this property. They really knew nothing about vineyard land, but they had had that Cabernet, the 72 Villemont Eden. They loved it and were dreaming of making great Cabernet. That was their favorite varietal. And when they looked at this property and they figured out that it was next door to, I think that helped them kind of put it all together and make an educated guess on a decision. And then they found out that Nils was next door, and they just kind of met him. Again, Justin Meyer, our neighbor, introduced him. They had gone to Davis together years ago, and they hit it off. And Nils was looking for something different, and he came aboard and made our first wines for us, which was wonderful. But Michael is, let's see, he's been making wine in Oakville for over 27 years. He worked for the Mondavi family for a long time. And my parents had drank a lot of Mondavi Fumé Cabernet Blanc over the years, and then Vichon Chavignon, if you remember that wine. It was Chenin Blancs and Sauvignon Blanc blend. And Michael was making that wine, and that's how they kind of first ran into him. And they said, you know, we don't like the idea of Chavignon, but we like the style. We like the zippy, clean, bright style. And so Michael came aboard and really changed how we make our white wines here. We encouraged him to keep the reds very similar to where they were. We liked the style, but that was a big change for us on our white wine program.
How badly affected were you by the spring frost?
That's an interesting question. It was a really, it was a very hard frost. We had 42 days of frost in a row, which is a long period, not unheard of. This ranch typically gets frost every year. It's not a big deal, and we're prepared for it. But we didn't have any terrible crop issues here. We have a traditional sprinkler system for the frost here with our irrigation pond. Our other ranch in Yonville is not normally prone to frost, and we call it a 10-year frost zone. So just south of the Oakville Knoll, you have more bay influence from, you know, Drake's Bay coming up into the Carneros area. And the closer you are to that, usually the safer you are with frost, or if you're in the mountains. We usually have some fans, and that you turn those on usually, and that, you know, solves the problem. But this year it didn't put much of a dent in it. So we probably lost 20-22% on the Chardonnay. We haven't pulled in the Merlot yet, but we're estimating it will be lower. My uncle really got nailed. We buy a bunch of Sauvignon Blanc. About 40% of our Sauvignon Blanc is purchased from a Childs Valley vineyard, and he lost 30-40% of his crop. And again, normally in the hills, the mountains, not prone to frost, it was so badly burned this year that vines were blackened, and that's quite a heavy frost. We don't see a frost like this, but every 20, 25 years, and this was our year. It was tough.
It was a pretty cool afternoon when I got here, with more fog than I would have expected. Is this normal?
What's normal? I mean, you know, there's different things. If you talk to old timers, they'll talk about, you know, trends in weather. But no, I mean, it's unusual to be this cool, for the fog to linger this long in September. No, normally, you know, anywhere in the Bay Area, you can say September, October is our golden time to visit. You always tell people to come to the Bay Area in September because it's so beautiful. You don't usually have fog. No, it's normal to have cool temperatures in the 50s at night. Totally normal this time of year. But with the fog is the unusual factor. But I got to tell you, with the fires we had earlier this summer, we're all really appreciating the cool weather now and slowing down. You know, I was talking to the guys crushing, and they're just finishing Sauvignon Blanc. I asked them about Merlot. I said, I think the Merlot over at Yonville, because I live on the Yonville Ranch at Hillview, I think it's done, guys. And they said, oh yeah, we know. We just can't bring it in today. We have to wait another day or two to finish off the Sauvignon Blanc, get it out of the way. Then we can, you know, crush the Merlot. So things are pushing it a little bit. The cab seems to be cooling down because of the cool weather. We're going to typically, you know, we'll harvest the middle of October, and we won't harvest till then, it doesn't look like. But the Merlot is definitely ready to roll in.
Let's talk about the Groth Cabernet.
Well, whenever I do a sales presentation out there in the world, I always say Oakville is a Cabernet ghetto, because it certainly is. When we moved here, first thing we did was plant Chardonnay, right? So we're city dwellers. What did we know? But, you know, that was indicative of the times. It was the 70s when this area was planted to Vitis vinifera. There were no grapes except for the Tokalon Ranch, which is the historic planting in Oakville. So that was planted turn of the century. Today, Robert Mondavi Winery still owns almost like 85% of the Tokalon Ranch. Other than that, this was mixed farming. It was prunes, it was walnuts, it was cattle, it was you name it. So this ranch was cobbled together. It was probably four different, you know, plots, and put together in the 70s and planted to grapes in 1971 and 72 by Justin Meyer, the guy who, his widow still owns 5 acres next door. It's the famous Bonnie's Vineyard, where they made a single vineyard cab for years. But not everything was cab here. It was Riesling and Chardonnay and little bits of this and that. Over the years, now that the Oakville Appellation, the sub-appellation in Napa Valley, was formed in 1995, you would think it would be a natural getting the neighbors together and deciding on certain things about their little sub-appellation. Not so, because you've got guys like, of course, Robert Mondavi, but you also have the Heights family, Joe Heights, and he was dead set against forming the Oakville Appellation. He'd worked his entire life on promoting Napa Valley. Tim Mondavi was a second-generation Mondavi. He's like, no, I really think we should do this. So luckily, you know, my dad was on Tim's side, and they gathered a few more neighbors and convinced everybody to form the Oakville Appellation. Today, we actually put the Oakville sub-appellation on our cab labels, and the Chardonnay and the Sauvignon Blanc are still Napa Valley because we source from both ranches. The Oakville Appellation has 79% of what's planted in Oakville today is Cabernet, and you have all the aforementioned folks. You've got the Mondavis, of course. The Mays Vineyard was made under the Heights label for Martha's Vineyard. You've got Joseph Phelps with their Bacchus Vineyard. You've got Leslie Rudd was Girard. Today it's Rudd. Tiny, you know, production, Harlan, Bond, Screaming Eagle, of course, your little cult darlings, but it's Cabernet. Cabernet is king in Oakville, definitely.
I met you for the first time at the auction, Napa Valley Barrel Auction this year, and I was curious how you did overall.
It was really fun. We ended up pretty even with previous year, which we were pleased with considering the state of the economy. And it's still kind of a new concept. That was its fourth year doing the e-lot as our version of our online silent auction. And the third year that they had opened it up to folks outside of the auction goers, which I think is really cool. I think that's such a neat way to get people to see something about Napa Valley, something about the auction, without having to actually buy a ticket and show up and having to, you know, be here. They can kind of live vicariously online with what's going on and the kinds of events. And I ended up purchasing the Duckhorn lot, and it was neat because I enjoyed the experience and seeing what the customer was seeing on the other side as far as communication from a winery and from the Napa vintners. And it was gratifying to see that the vintners are so organized, the way they reach out to people, you know, make sure that everybody got the information they needed and got their wine delivered to them. So it was really fantastic. Yeah.
There's an event here in Napa that you talked to me about that happens in February, right?
I can't tell you how great it is. It's a different event. So it's trade oriented. So that may or may not be of interest to your audience, but it is such a concentrated room of owners, winemakers, press, and the guys who really make things happen. So you've got guys like Gary Fish from the East Coast, from Jersey. He, you know, Wally's is a wonderful wine shop out there. And then you've got, you know, the Wine House bought my lot, you know, last year, and I'm just delivering it now. And there are big guys in LA, K&L Wine Merchants, all the guys who really do a lot of telemarketing and online sales, but they're, you know, powerful buyers. You know, some of our distributors come, which is always amazing to me that they really want to be there. But you're tasting lots of wine. For example, so the Schaefer will do their Sunspot Vineyard. It might be a component of their Hillside Select, but you would never see it out there. It's an exclusive barrel of wine that will never be sold to anybody else. And then the Napa Vintners organize a special commemorative label each year. And that goes that you pack. We just finished packaging it up and sending it off. You're tasting unusual wines, which is incredible, but just meeting the guys who made the wine. They're standing right there. It's really fun. It's really an amazing event. So if you can, you got to come.
Suzanne, tell me what you think about screw caps.
We're very intrigued. As my brother and I, our generation, we really want to put the Sauvignon Blanc in a screw cap. I was at a restaurant last night and we ordered a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and she came over and, you know, just a little crack. And we all made jokes about, you really should learn a trick, like throwing it in the air and catching it, you know, behind your back or something, because it's kind of anticlimactic, but it's so much easier. And I don't know about you, but I always have a cold Sauvignon Blanc in my refrigerator at home. Sauvignon Blanc is very susceptible to cork taint. It's just more sensitive. You could put the same cork in a Chardonnay bottle and a Sauvignon Blanc bottle, and the SB would show it and the Chard wouldn't. And we've done a lot of trials and we've tried higher end cork and just nothing solved it. We went to a Noma cork, which is a foam with a hard plastic exterior. It is inert. You could still technically, the chances are like 0.002% chance of cork taint from this product. It's hard to work with. It's hard to get out of the bottle sometimes, and then you can't recork it and shove it back in the fridge because the cork is so hard. It's very difficult to force back in there. It takes a lot of force. And I hate that. And I just want it, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, it's our introductory wine. We really want it to be just easy access. And, you know, I know we would probably turn off a few customers, but that's the one we would do it with. Cab, we're still interested in aging in cork. Even our Chardonnay, we're doing, you know, 10-year trials where we really like, you know, the age quality on the wine. And we're definitely looking into it. It's capital intensive the first year, but, you know, it really pays for itself in a few years. So hopefully, if I get my way, you'll be seeing 2009 Groth in a screw cap. So,
Suzanne, thanks for welcoming us to Groth.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Ray.